You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the economic impact of the 1918 influenza outbreak and talk about what lessons there could be for government response to the coronavirus today. First, it's the 50th anniversary of Earth Day today, a commemoration championed by Wisconsin Senator and environmentalist Gaylord Nelson. Our relationship with nature and the earth is different in this time of the coronavirus pandemic. Our lives and livelihoods are being deeply affected by a virus that has spread across the globe, likely originating in other animals and jumping to humans. On the other hand, many kinds of pollution have decreased drastically because so many billions of people around the world are staying at home, reducing air and motor travel to a fraction of the usual rates. Michael Wasegijig Price is the traditional ecological knowledge specialist at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission in Odana, Wisconsin. He is Anishinaabe and a tribal member of Wikwemecon First Nations in Ontario. Michael has a Master of Science in Forestry from the University of Montana and a Certificate of Ojibwe Language Instruction from Bemidji State University. He joins us now for a look at a piece he wrote for Tribal College Journal titled We Must Listen to the Earth. You can find a link to that article at WPR.org/Central Time. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, miigwech. Thank you for having me on.
What are some of the signs, Michael, you point to that show maybe our relationship with nature being out of balance?
Well, when I first began to hear about the coronavirus and I began to reflect on it, I thought about the words of an elder here from Red Lake Nation in Minnesota. And he wrote these words that were relative to a book that we wrote about animals. And this book was called Awasiensug. And it's written entirely in the Ojibwe language. But one of the things that he wrote in that book, and he wrote it in the acknowledgement section, was this small section, the small phrase that said, Gego Bapinina Ma Kane Awea Gishpin Ejigayan Gika Bija Giwain Dagon. And what that phrase says in Ojibwe is don't put down or offend anyone. If you do, it will come back on you. So that was a really strong statement that he made for this book. And it got me to thinking about this coronavirus and thinking about those words, it will come back on you. And so when I think about what happened with this virus, a lot of the studies have suggested that this virus originated at a wet market in Southeast Asia, in Wuhan, China. But it's had an effect on people globally. I think about the interconnectedness of all living beings, not only humans, but animals as well. So that was a line of thought that I had.
In that piece we mentioned in Tribal College Journal, the feeling I got reading it was that you're looking for us to deal with the earth and with nature with more of a sense of, I think, humility is the word that was popping into my mind. Is that a fair way to characterize, mm-hmm. or at least in part, how we relate to the natural world?
Well, one thing our Anishinaabe culture tells us is about relationship, respect, and reciprocity for the natural world. And it's in all of our ceremonies. It's in all of our traditions. It's in our language as well. And so this is the way our culture tells us that we need to perceive and interact with the natural world. And to give you an example, the wild rice harvest season will begin at the end of August, around the 1st of September. So when wild rice harvesters go out to harvest rice, we're pushing a canoe down through the rice bed, or knocking the rice into the canoe. Well, there's a certain percentage of the rice that actually falls over the side of the canoe and into the water. A lot of people would regard that as being waste or being careless with the harvest. But a lot of our elders say that that rice that goes over the side of the edge is supposed to happen. And what that does is that it reseeds the rice beds for next year. It provides a food source for wildlife, for waterfowl, And so we want to humble ourselves, and we don't want to get too greedy with the harvest. Otherwise, as that elder stated, that it could come back on us in an adverse way.
You also write about gratitude toward other living things, including animals we might eat. How would we approach that?
Well, speaking for myself, I'm a member of the bear clan, Makwadudem. And in my culture and in my worldview, the bears are actually a close relative. And they're also a teacher to me as well. So I see this particular animal species as being a guide or an educator in my life. And of course, I have a degree in forestry. So I've studied the plants all my life. Well, the bears have taught us about herbal medicines and have taught us about how to forage for medicines in the forest and in the natural world. So that's the kind of relationship that I have to that one particular species.
We're talking to Michael Wasegijig Price from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission in Odanna, Wisconsin. We're talking about a piece he wrote in the Tribal College Journal titled "We Must Listen to the Earth." And in that piece, Michael, you talk about the food system as it exists in a lot of American culture and around the world, not having that sense of balance or humility or gratitude. What do you see as problems with the way we produce our food, maybe our meat in particular?
Well, I've done some research on this, and if you just look at the way that we produce our food in this country, this country is tasked with feeding millions and millions of people very quickly and very efficiently. And of course, we've, you know, established that type of industry around the world. But what ends up happening, you know, these animals, livestock animals like chickens, beef, swine, you know, they all have the same type of emotional landscape that we have. They have feelings of anxiety, of terror, I just feel that these types of emotions are shared not only with us, but with all animals as well. So in many of these industries, I feel that these animals are put through these types of circles. And for us as traditional Anishinaabe people, we try to avoid the suffering of any animal, especially during the hunt. Many young hunters, both young girls and young boys, are taught how to kill a deer with the least amount of suffering. And so we prepare for those types of hunts using ceremony. And then after the kill, we have ceremony after that. And so that helps us to preserve that relationship that we have to the wildlife.
In our last couple minutes, Michael, it is Earth Day, a time when many of us are marking this 50-year tradition. Can you leave us with some thoughts from much older traditions on ways we can reflect on Earth Day and look to the future, even in the midst of this pandemic crisis?
Well, I believe this is from my perspective, reflected on my own traditions and my own teachings, is that this virus has come to us for a reason, and we have to figure out what that reason is. And many times, these types of illness are the indication of imbalance or the indication of something that should not be happening. And so these are some of the reflections I have on this particular virus, but also too, how do we establish reestablish our relationships with the natural world? What can we do differently to make this a more sustainable and vibrant world for all living beings, not just ourselves as human beings, as consumers?
Michael, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Ahau miigwech. Thank you for having me on.
Michael Wasegijig Price is the Traditional Ecological Knowledge Specialist at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission in Odanah, Wisconsin. He joined us today, Earth Day, to talk about his article published in the Tribal College Journal, the title, We Must Listen to the Earth. You can find a link to that article over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk to an economic development specialist from UW-Madison about the economic toll of the 1918 influenza outbreak and how the government's ability to provide economic support has changed since then and some possible lessons to learn from just over a century ago. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress is poised to pass more emergency relief spending this week. It's also starting oversight work on trillions of dollars that it's already approved. We'll get the latest stimulus spending news from a congressional reporter as part of our weekly roundup of news in national politics. First, one of the closest comparisons we have to the new coronavirus is the 1918 influenza outbreak. That outbreak ultimately killed millions of people around the world and had a huge impact on the economy. While there are points of comparison with today, there were some big differences, too. For one, the U.S. government's ability to provide economic relief to the tune of trillions of dollars like we're seeing today. That's something that our next guest recently took a closer look at, along with other differences in the economic impact of the 1918 flu and today's novel coronavirus. Tessa Conroy is a development specialist and assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. She talked to WPR host Keely Boltina about her essay for WisContext on the topic.
Broadly, what can we say about the economic impact of the 1918 influenza around the globe?
The economic impact was certainly felt around the globe. And some of the studies that I've been looking at recently suggest around a 6% decrease in GDP for the typical country due to this flu-related decline in economic activity.
And did we see kind of a similar response in the U.S. or was it different in some way?
The U.S. Certainly had declines. I mean, I've been thinking most about Wisconsin. And what was interesting for me is that, you know, based on comparisons, the decline in activity looked a lot like it does today in that people were having to stay home, that a lot of our movie theaters, restaurants, bars were closed down. So certainly businesses were missing out on revenues. So that comparison is certainly interesting to me.
So we can draw some parallels between the 1918 flu and what's happening now with COVID-19. And some of those come from what some consider to be, you know, extreme public health measures, telling people you have to stay home. What does that comparison look like?
Right. Wisconsin was really interesting in that respect, in that we were the only state to issue a comprehensive statewide measure. So we were an earlier adopter of having a state board of health and built a network of local health boards as well. So by the time the 1918 flu happened, we had a pretty well-established public health infrastructure that we used to respond to the flu. So we were able to ask people to stay at home, keep places closed, keep people safe at a large scale. And interestingly, what we see is that definitely the 1918 pandemic resulted in economic losses. But some of the more recent work shows that the places that did intervene, that did kind of impose social distancing and these types of measures, their economies, once the pandemic was over, their economies performed at least as good as those that were less stringent.
Do we have any idea why that might have been the case?
I could speculate, you know, that maybe, with fewer people sick, that people are able to go back to work sooner, perhaps more quickly restoring consumer confidence that the pandemic is under control. So perhaps some of those effects might help us understand those differences.
Now, not everything that we did with the 1918 pandemic actually does translate. You say that the comparison doesn't always hold up. But what are the ways that we shouldn't think of these two major public health situations as the same?
Right. So the differences are probably more interesting to me than the similarities in that. So, for example, I mean, the virus in 1918 was particularly severe for working age people. And today it seems that it's most severe for those that are probably out of the workforce. So in 1918, when people got sick, it's more likely that households lost a primary breadwinner. So that was one thing that was interesting. today, too, we have a kind of widespread geographically dispersed production. So as one part of the world encounters the virus and addresses it, it's hard for that not to have ripple effects into the supply chain that affect other parts of the world. But I think the biggest difference is that I noticed were really in policy, that before the 1930s, we didn't see monetary policy the way we see it today. We didn't see fiscal policy. The unemployment insurance program didn't take shape until the 1930s. And same with Social Security. And these are two programs that definitely, I imagine, could have helped ease the burden for families, over 100 years ago as they faced that pandemic.
And the Federal Reserve was also in its infancy then. So how has the government's ability to respond and provide economic relief really changed since?
We're seeing a much longer menu of policy options, both on the monetary side and the fiscal side. So already we've seen the Federal Reserve deploy several policies on the monetary side, including lower interest rates, kind of a suite of actions to stabilize markets. On the fiscal side, we're seeing really large spending initiatives, some of those aimed at businesses, some at households, and some government spending just to respond to the virus and get the CDC the resources and other institutions the resources that they need to respond. And we hadn't really seen, this sort of large-scale spending before perhaps the New Deal.
And what is the strategy there? Help us understand why that spending might make a difference now in a way it couldn't in 1918.
So these policies are aimed at kind of different parts of the economy, but mainly in increasing spending. So when the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, this is meant to lower the cost of debt for big purchases like houses and cars. So hopefully encourage consumers to go spending. Some of these measures to restore stability in the markets is meant to increase confidence, make sure that we have the liquidity that we need so that everybody can meet their debt obligations. For households, again, restoring consumer confidence, making sure that they can pay their bills in the short term, but also hoping that, down the road, we feel confident about purchasing concert tickets and things like that as well. So a number of measures to get kind of spending back where it was and help families and businesses get through. The loan programs for businesses in particular, expect another bill coming through. So these are all meant to kind of help people meet their current needs and get some money flowing again in the economy.
Tessa Conroy is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics. And we're talking about her writing for Wiscontext about the 1918 flu, what we can learn and what we can't quite learn when we compare what's happening right now with COVID-19 to what happened back then. And Tessa, you say there are some economic impacts we saw in 1918 that were short-lived and some were longer lasting. What do we see in each of those categories?
So definitely some short-term and immediate losses, large-scale declines in manufacturing, for example. But then we also saw wage increases. So as people fell ill or sadly didn't make it through the virus, we saw a labor shortage. So those people that were available, perhaps having to put in a little extra time or work a little extra harder at their jobs. So we saw some wage increases. And we also saw some state-level income growth associated with the pandemic. But relatively short-lived on that front. On some of the longer-term impacts, there's some evidence that people who were born in the wake of the 1918 pandemic went on to achieve poor education and economic outcomes later in life. So a mix of outcomes to consider based on the 1918 experience.
And what is it about our response now when we're trying to pull in information about what's changed and what's the same? Why is this such a complicated scenario now, even compared to 1918?
Right. So the COVID-19 crisis definitely is unique in that. Oftentimes when we think about an economic downturn, we might think of kind of one trigger, a demand shock or perhaps a supply shock or a financial shock. With the COVID-19 crisis, we're looking at potential aspects of all three. So multiple aspects of the economy to be thinking about and juggle as we make policy.
And now that we kind of understand more about the different kinds of policy approaches that are happening now than in 1918, how do we figure out how to judge what's happening and figure out if this is helping or if we're not in favor of the policies of states and the federal government right now?
I think there will be a decades-long conversation of if we're doing it right, in the right amount, at the right time. But I think when we look at some of the policies right now, you know, unemployment insurance, we're definitely seeing claims balloon as we go through this. When we think about the small business loan programs and how quickly those have been utilized, certainly these policies are making an impact for households and businesses right now, right away. And it's hard to argue that those aren't important impacts to think about as we continue making our way through this crisis.
And as someone who works on economic development, what are you keeping your eye on as we move forward when we try to figure out the economic impact of this new coronavirus?
I'm definitely thinking about, you know, these programs and how long they can last and how long we're going to be in this sort of extreme dire straits. Hopefully, you know, we can find our way back to a more normal environment so that our businesses and our households, our workers can find some element of normalcy again and, you know, can start to step away from needing these programs as badly as they are and again resume kind of normal market and labor market activity.
Tessa, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was UW-Madison's Tessa Conroy talking to WPR host Keely Boltina. You can learn more about the economic impact of the 1918 flu and how it compares to today's coronavirus outbreak in Tessa's piece at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Congress is apparently on the verge of passing more emergency spending, mostly aimed at supporting small businesses during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll get the details on that and on oversight efforts for money already passed and being spent right now. It's all part of our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, despite a state Supreme Court challenge by Republicans, Governor Evers' Safer at Home order will be extended starting Friday. We'll get the latest on where things stand with the case. First, we take a look at the week's news from the nation's capital, where an interim coronavirus relief package aimed at helping small businesses is awaiting a vote in the House after passing the Senate yesterday. Meanwhile, different agencies are starting their oversight of last month's $2.2 trillion spending bill. That comes after President Trump removed an inspector general slated to coordinate that work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think oversight is important for this emergency relief spending? What do you want to make sure money goes or doesn't go to? Do you have questions about what Congress has already passed or is thinking about for the future? Are you concerned about the way the money has been spent or given or lent so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kyle Chaney is a congressional reporter for Politico. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this current bill in Congress this week, $484 billion that passed the Senate yesterday. Most of this goes towards small business support, some other money going around. Can you break down the basics of what this is going to here?
Sure. So in the larger bill you mentioned, the $2.2 trillion bill was a large program for small businesses to basically help them avoid layoffs and maintain operations or at least just maintain their staff during the pandemic. And that program ran out of money really fast. So Congress agreed after a couple of weeks of pitched negotiations to pour more money into that program, another $320 billion to shore up, again, smaller businesses. Based on Democratic demands, another $75 billion for hospitals that are really struggling amid the pandemic to help them continue operations as well.
And this passed the Senate yesterday, as we mentioned. What are the prospects in the House? Now, I know they're trying to approve things when they can without showing up. As we learned over the last few weeks, one member of Congress can force a quorum to show up. What are the prospects for this thing passing quickly and without bringing people back to Washington?
They're zero, because they actually are on the way back to Washington.
Well, they are.
As we speak. Yeah, they are. They'll be a full Congress voting on this thing Thursday morning. And it's expected to pass pretty widely, but there will be some detractors, even more than the single member that stopped things last or that got in the way last time. But there will be a full vote in the House.
And they are expected, as you say, to pass it. So if that's the case, and the president signs it, how soon can money start flowing again to small businesses who may already be queued up for relief money?
Presumably right away, as soon as the president puts his signature on it, and it may run out almost as fast, because apparently the backlog has been so enormous that even this $300 billion may go very quickly.
One of the concerns about the previous round is this money going towards small businesses ended up going to some pretty big ones. Has that been a big talking point in Washington over the last few days?
Huge. Well, in our conversations with lawmakers, they're very concerned about how this money has been applied or misapplied. It's the consequence of passing something like they did, $2.2 trillion plus another $500 billion plus some other big piece of legislation, in as fast and as hurried a manner as they did, is the checks on this stuff, the way to make sure that every penny is being put in the right place, they're not as strong as people would like. And so you're seeing those kind of issues crop up pretty frequently. And so we're hearing a lot from lawmakers now, in hindsight, just how much of a challenge that is.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about the deal approved yesterday, saying here he's starting to worry about the amounts of money being spent. Here's a listen.
And I think it's also time to begin to think about the amount of debt that we're adding to our country and the future impact of that. And I think we've also seen, with this catastrophic damage to the economy, that until we can begin to open up the economy, we can't spend enough money to solve the problem.
And Kyle, there was already concern before the whole pandemic that in a good economic time, we were running up surprisingly big annual deficits anyway. Now we're adding a whole lot of money to that. Is that something that other members of Congress are starting to worry about?
It's the minority for sure, but you're starting to hear that creep into the conversation. I think there was a widespread understanding that things were so dire and it was such an emergency that some of those more philosophical and ideological debates could be put on hold to get money out the door quickly. As you've gotten to round three, and soon they'll be talking about round four of major packages to address this, we're starting to hear those concerns come back in a big way, especially from conservatives. Who are usually, vocal about things like debt and deficit. This is, as Democrats are saying, we need another major package, maybe to save cities and towns who are struggling. We're starting to hear the deficit debt concerns that may make that more of a challenge than these earlier packages.
We're talking to Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter for Politico. It's our weekly roundup of some of the latest news in national politics. A lot of the big news this week, congressional efforts to pass more relief efforts for small businesses and oversight of the previous spending allowed. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Plover. Kevin, hi.
Hello. How are you?
What do you want to bring up, Kevin?
Well, I would like to point out that other than the $1,200 that was and is going to the average American, that prior to the COVID-19, supply-side economics, as it was envisioned by Ronald Reagan and eventually also supported by establishment Democrats, has resulted in a hollowing out of the country, and it resulted in skyrocketing deficits, failing infrastructure. So I find it interesting that the aid packages that have been put together thus far are addressing the supply side, trying to prop up business and businesses, small businesses to very large businesses and large corporations. Unfortunately, what history tells us is that with a lack of aggregate demand, in not addressing the lack of aggregate demand, which was done in 1929, and they tried to solve the Great Depression early on with supply side, with actions on the supply side, things just continued to spiral downwards.
Kevin, thanks for the call. I think I see where you're going. And Kyle, there's been talk from the president and some in Congress for infrastructure spending, you know, more money into highways, bridges, things like that, that might address that demand side our caller is talking about. I haven't heard anybody talking about that, though, in a couple of weeks. It was a big story for a little while, and it seems to have fallen by the wayside.
It's still on the table, but Mitch McConnell, in additional comments, has said we're not going to talk about the next big spending bill at least until Congress is back in Washington. And because we don't have an actual timetable, I mean, they're slated to come back on May 4th. That could slip if the pandemic, if the peak of that still hasn't arrived in Washington and in this area. So, you know, if then they have to begin negotiations again, these can be very difficult, probably more difficult than ever, because Democrats want these money, this money for cities and towns. But there is talk about infrastructure being in that next package. But we may be a long way off from that.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at the latest round of federal relief spending and how that money is being overseen by government agencies. We're going to turn to that oversight subject Kyle's been following closely, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about this emergency money ending up where it's needed most? Do you think keeping track of potential fraud should be part of these packages? Are you concerned about the amount of money getting spent? Are you do you trust the Trump administration right now to make sure this money is spent appropriately? Are you worried about loopholes left by Congress along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter for Politico, looking at the week's news out of Washington. Kyle, let's turn to a subject you've been following closely and writing about, oversight of how all this money, you know, a couple trillion plus dollars are being spent. What, first of all, in the executive branch, there have been shakeups in terms of inspectors general who are supposed to be watching what happens with this money. What have we seen there?
So the inspectors general, you know, operate inside federal agencies to monitor, make sure funds that they're appropriated are handled properly and not misspent or wasted or mismanaged. And the president has recently begun bristling against some of these internal watchdogs, particularly when they issue findings not to his liking or that seem to be critical of his leadership or his team's leadership. So we saw most recently he demoted essentially the inspector general who was picked to oversee the pandemic response. This is maybe the most powerful oversight tool Congress created, was this committee of inspectors general to review how this $2.2 trillion was going to be applied. And they picked, the inspectors general picked someone to oversee, to manage that. And the president demoted him, essentially took him out of the running, and so they have to pick a new person to do that, and they haven't done that yet.
You also write, though, that the Congressional Oversight Office, the Government Accountability Office, is gearing up. Government Accountability Office is gearing up to do oversight of their own. Can you talk about their role and how they're getting ready to look into this really unprecedented amount of spending passed in such a short time?
Sure. So the GAO, as it's known, it's a very little known office. It's in the legislative branch, but it's independent of Congress. And it has all these oversight tools that a lot of other, that inspectors general have and others, to do kind of probing reviews of how money is spent to make sure Congress's intent is met and their demands are met. So they're going to go out and blanket federal agencies and make sure that all this $2.2 trillion is handled right. There are coronavirus tests being administered properly and distributed properly by the federal government. The money that Congress is targeting for that is being used wisely. So we're not going to hear results for a while, but they're out there looking now, and that's really the first wave of oversight being done on this massive new legislation.
And this is one whereas the president can, I guess, if he wants to hire and fire inspectors general or demote them, as the case may be, the GAO is out of the reach of the president. Do I have that right?
Yes, because it's in the legislative branch that he can stonewall them, as he has Congress on several occasions and sensitive issues, but he can't actually remove the investigators in this case.
What's the attitude toward the GAO from members of Congress in both parties?
They love the GAO. This is a bipartisan tool. This is something Democrats and Republicans can request reviews, and they're usually honored when they have the resources to do it on an equal basis. So, and it's very nonpartisan. These are technocrats and people who are experts in their field, and so Congress appreciates this tool that they can use as they see fit.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jan is with us in Racine. Jan, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting program. One of the concerns I have, and we saw that with the last big bill that passed that was to go to certain groups to help alleviate the financial disaster. And what happens is stories come out afterwards. Well, there was a technicality. There was a loophole. And groups or people or businesses who really it wasn't aimed at them end up getting money. And then possibly other people who are businesses who were supposed to be the targets end up being shortchanged. I don't know if this is just a concern of mine, but it feels like those stories come out after every big bill.
Jan, thanks a lot for the call. And Kyle, I know Jan is not the only one with that concern right now. We touched on, for example, the small business money earlier. Have we seen other examples of money going to people or groups who maybe weren't intended or in some cases didn't expect it?
One of the more unusual issues that's arisen is that some of the $1,200 stimulus checks have gone out to people who are deceased because it's based on tax information that filed, within the last 2 years. That's something that regulators are looking at now. And I think the issue that Jan raised is one of the reasons I'm so focused on oversight is, every time massive legislation like this has passed, we see these issues arise, sometimes in a very prominent way. And so, in the 2008-2009 financial crisis, this became such a huge political and economic issue that Congress promised we won't let it happen again, yet we're seeing the same kind of issues arise now.
Jan, thanks for that call. We'll go to Jolene now in Stoughton. Jolene, hi.
Hi, I don't have a specific question, but just a comment. Wow, wow, wow. I almost dropped off the road listening to Mitch McConnell and all of his concern about the debt that we're taking on because of these stimulus packages. Where was his concern a couple of years ago during that tax cut? I am just floored by that.
Jolene, thanks for the call. Excuse me, Kyle, there was criticism of the Republican passed tax program back then for its impact on the deficit. Are people bringing that up now?
Yeah, and I expect that to come back. That Republicans may seem to be concerned about the debt and deficit when they're pushing back against policies they just don't support, as opposed to as a matter of principle when it's something like a tax cut or military spending or things that the party generally favors. That it's a very selective application of their concerns about debt and deficit.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jolene. We'll go to Dennis now in Eau Claire County. Dennis, hello.
Hello. My question is there a clause in there that prevents lobbyists and government employees, the senators and the president and his immediate family, is there a clause in there that prevents them from being able to grab some of that money?
Dennis, thanks for the call. I know that was in the works during the package, and I think there was something for the president and his family, but I don't remember how all that shook out.
There is. So there's language that explicitly says no member of Congress, no member of the executive branch, the president or his family can access any of the funds meant for businesses. And there's a lot of concern about how it's going to be applied, which again brings me back to the importance of oversight here, because the way it's written and the way the president's companies are structured, is there a loophole there? But explicitly under the letter of the law, he and his family are not supposed to have access to this pot of money, members of Congress too. And lobbyists is an ongoing discussion about how to impose restrictions on making sure that the money itself isn't used for lobbying as companies obtain it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Kyle Chaney from Politico, looking at some of the big news in national politics. Let's take another call before we move on to one other issue. Jeff is with us in Green Bay. Jeff, hello.
Hello there. How are you today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, my wife and I have an interesting point. We're both business people, and we wonder how much of the bailout money is going to businesses that were failing. You know, is there any requirement that they show that they've been operating for, the last 3 years, or what are the requirements there? I mean, are we bailing out some failing businesses, I guess, is our concern.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Kyle, is there any kind of, viability test along those lines?
So there's not, or at least if there is, it's not necessarily being applied. I think I've heard that point come up just in the last day or so, that companies that were already expected to have trouble financially are now, basically sustaining themselves on this bailout money, that they're just going to be right back in the same dire straits they're in, but just delayed a couple of months, whereas companies that actually were fiscally sound and surviving but now are struggling may be blocked, whereas other companies that are struggling were struggling before are getting it. So this I expect to come back as an issue. Congress will look to tighten the requirements to make sure it's companies that are fiscally viable, financially viable going forward.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to move to another story in the news this week. President Trump tweeted that he was planning to temporarily ban immigration into the U.S. He elaborated on that in a press briefing yesterday, saying there was an executive order coming out soon. Here is a brief listen to what he had to say.
In order to protect American workers, I will be issuing a temporary suspension of immigration into the United States. You heard about that last night. By pausing immigration, we'll help put unemployed Americans first in line for jobs as America reopens. So important.
There's some confusion about what this is actually going to entail. Kyle, what do we know about who this does and doesn't apply to?
So I think what we know is that the bottom line, this doesn't change things that dramatically from where we're at, because the administration already stopped processing visas for the most part. And there's an exemption for temporary workers, which is an important thing for businesses, but also essentially keeps the status quo. So it's really other people seeking to relocate to the United States, not for necessarily for work purposes. And so it's seen more as a political signal than anything else. There will be real implications for it, for people who are trying to bring family members to the United States. But for the most part, this seems more of a posturing position for the president on an issue that matters to his base.
And Kyle, in our last minute, what are you watching for next? News is happening fast lately.
Just how quickly can Congress come up with a system to function while they're not in Washington? They've struggled for weeks now. Can we vote remotely? They're not even sure they can do it constitutionally. And they were supposed to have a vote on something tomorrow on that and postponed it. So can Congress work while they're socially distancing?
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter at Politico. He joined us for a look at the week's news out of Washington, including what's in the latest coronavirus relief package expected to pass the House this week. A big part of that is going to help small businesses, to add more money to a program previously passed that ran out of money aimed at helping small businesses keep paying their employees while they're shut down because of a state and local shutdown orders. On tomorrow's show, by the way, we're going to talk to a Small Business Administration official about that program, what resources are out there to help small businesses in this tough time, how to apply for aid under the old program or under the new one as money comes out, and what the new federal funding is going to mean. We'll take your questions along the way. That's coming up tomorrow at 4:30 here on Central Time. By the way, thanks to everyone who gave last week during our kind of low-key spring member drive where we asked for your support for the conversations you count on here on Wisconsin Public Radio. To everybody who gave then, if you've given in the past, if you're a sustainer and you're sort of constantly giving, thank you so much. We really do appreciate it, and we couldn't do all the work we do without your support now and over the years. Thank you so much. I'm a little late to the table on this one, but I just found out that April, this current month, is National Card and Letter Writing Month here in the United States. That's pretty good timing. There are some reports that more people are turning to letter writing over the last month or two as a special way to keep in touch with people, since our personal contact and travel are limited. We're going to talk about letter writing tomorrow on Central Time with some advice on writing for those of us who are way, way out of practice. And we want to hear from you. We'll invite your calls during the conversation, but you can get started right now. You can give us a quick note over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or email ideas@WPR.org. Unfortunately, if you send us an actual letter, it won't get to me in time to share it on the show. Let us know if you've gotten into letter writing in the last few weeks, whether it's the first time you've done it in years or the first time ever. Or if you were already a regular letter writer, tell us why you like to keep up with your correspondence. And if you receive personal mail, let us know what it means to you. Again, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page, tweet us at Central Time WPR, or email ideas@WPR.org for a conversation on letter writing tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.